Hello, you're about to listen to Series 2 of Lady Killers. New episodes will be released weekly. But if you're in the UK and you can't wait, you can hear it all right now, before anywhere else. First, on BBC Sounds. Welcome to a new series of Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4, with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. On the 12th of June, 1871, four-year-old Sidney Barker is on holiday with his family in Brighton on the south coast of England. And he meets an agonising death after eating a chocolate poisoned with strychnine.
He was crying and trembling at the top of the staircase. We wrapped him in a blanket and put his feet in mustard water, but by the time a doctor arrived, the child's legs and arms were stiff and stretched out. And he'd ceased crying. 5 minutes after, he was dead.
So begins one of the most bizarre and remarkable cases of the Victorian era. It's a story of thwarted passion, lethal confectionery, and a very dangerous lady killer indeed.
I am sending a few homemade cakes for the children. Those wrapped up are flavoured on purpose for yourself to enjoy. You will guess who this is from. I can't mystify you, I fear.
I'm joined by a crack team of investigators to take a look, a feminist look actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes committed by murderesses in Britain, North America and Australia. We hear their words, their voices. And we ask, what drove these ordinary women to do these extraordinary things? What do these lady killers tell us about the world they lived in and about other women's lives in the past? And what might they also tell us about our lives today? The clever and devious lady killer we're looking at this time presided over a reign of terror in Brighton in the early 1870s, in a case that gripped Victorian imaginations and sent the press into a frenzy. Rosalind Crone, Professor of History at the Open University and our in-house historian, went to Brighton to investigate.
In early June 1871, the Barker family from South London came to Brighton for a seaside holiday. Albert Barker, a dressing case maker, his wife Letitia, and their four-year-old son Sidney, together with Letitia's brothers, Charles and Ernest Miller, who were sons of a coach builder. And the family took lodgings at 30 West Street, a few doors down from Maynard's Confectioners, where Charles Miller bought the chocolates that poisoned his nephew.
Hi, can I have this one, please?
Give us £1, please.
Thank you very much.
Buying a treat is part of coming on holiday. And today I can be very confident that my chocolate won't poison me. But that was not the case in the 19th century. Back then, the food and drink industry was largely unregulated. And this meant that manufacturers would add substances to products to make them cheaper or more attractive. Sugar was expensive, so some sweet makers would use plaster of Paris instead. Lead, copper and arsenic might also be used for sweet makers as colour enhancers.
John Maynard swore that he hadn't added anything untoward to his chocolates. So how had the poison got there? Was it perhaps a disgruntled employee? Was it maybe an accident with some rat poison? At the inquest into Sidney Barker's death, all of these possibilities were explored and dismissed. But as the inquest unfolds, we're led to believe that Sidney wasn't the only person to have been made ill by Maynard's chocolates.
I was seized with violent internal pains, a burning in the throat and a feeling of lightness in that region. The saliva kept flowing into the mouth and I was seized with a trembling all over and felt an indescribable sensation. On the same day, I took the remainder of the chocolate creams to Mr. Maynard and told him what had occurred. He assured me I was mistaken in supposing it was the chocolate creams which had affected me.
But despite her efforts to pin the blame onto Maynard's, the inquest is inconclusive. Now, who is this passionate and slightly strange witness? She's Christiana Edmonds, the well-educated, middle-aged, spinster daughter of William Edmonds, an architect from Margate on the Kent coast. But Christiana's family has had to live with poor mental health, both her brother and her father having died in asylums. After her father's death, Christiana and her mother moved to Brighton to make a fresh start. Their circumstances are genteel but straitened. In Brighton, Christiana develops a romantic obsession with her doctor, Charles Beard, who lives just across the park from her in a Grand Regency house. He is married with small children, but even so, she bombards him with passionate letters. He destroys almost all of them, but this one survives.
Caro mio, come and see me, darling, now you have time. Mother and I have been looking forward to your holiday so that we can see you. Don't be biased by any relatives. Act as your kind heart tells you, and make a poor little thing happy. And fancy a long, long kiss.
Gosh, that's rather sexy, isn't it? Charles Beard tries to cut off all contact with Christiana, but her obsession takes a deadly turn. One night in September 1870, she turns up at the Beards' house when Charles is away. One of the servants shows her into the drawing room. Here, Christiana explains to Charles's wife, Emily, that she's brought some treats, Maynard's chocolate creams, actually, for the children. Christiana next does something rather strange. She goes over to Emily and puts one of the chocolates right into her mouth. Emily immediately notices the chocolate has a cold, strangely metallic taste, and she leaves the room to spit it out. When she returns, her visitor rapidly makes her excuses and leaves. For the next few hours, Emily feels extremely unwell. She has terrible diarrhea, and that's because Christiana had poisoned the chocolate with strychnine. With me to try to understand this outlandish case is Dr. Gwen Adshead, for many years a consultant psychiatrist and psychotherapist at Broadmoor Hospital. Gwen, welcome to Lady Killers.
Hello, Lucy.
This is a gripping case from my point of view. She's developed this dangerous passion for Dr. Charles Beard, and she's tried to poison his wife. In the 19th century, having a sort of delusional relationship like this would have been called erotomania. Yes, today would we call this stalking? Is that the modern equivalent?
Well, I guess that erotomania was the early term for the kind of delusional attachment that gives rise to kind of stalking behaviours. And what this is really about is the development of a one-sided passion, typically, for one person for another. And it can give rise to very dangerous behaviours. One of the really interesting questions is whether the internet and social media has made a difference here, because, of course, this allows you, social media allows you a kind of contact, continuing fantasy contact with someone that simply wasn't possible in the 19th century.
Most people will have experienced unrequited love, having a crush on somebody that isn't reciprocated. Why, for some people, does it go beyond that?
There are lots of ideas about why that might be. It may be something to do with the fact that Christiana had experienced a lot of bereavement in the previous few years. She had lost a beloved father and a beloved brother, and had seen her own mother, I think, very distressed by this. So I wonder whether one possibility is that she was looking to make an attachment to somebody else, and that Dr. Beard came along as somebody who was kind and gentle and kind of paternal, I suspect. I think this attachment to Dr. Beard was completely delusional. I think that it's very likely that Dr. Beard had no interest in her whatsoever, but Christiana believed that there was a relationship between them, and she was not prepared to accept any other account.
Now, I think people thinking about stalkers would usually imagine a man. But how common is it for a woman to be the stalker, the person who has the inappropriate relationship.
It's true to say that most perpetrators of stalking are male, and especially any kind of stalking behaviour that's high risk. And that's because most perpetrators of high risk behaviour are men anyway. But I wouldn't want to minimise the risk that some women stalkers can pose to their victims. And of course, Christiana Edmonds is a case in point.
Well, when Dr. Charles Beard gets home, he's immediately suspicious. He thinks that Christiana Edmonds might be to blame for the poisoned chocolate. Christiana doesn't want this. She wants him to think well of her. So she devises a plan, which is essentially to frame Maynard's the confectioners. She tries to prove that Maynard's the problem, not her, and that Emily Beard only got poisoned by bad luck. So Christiana buys some bags of chocolates. She inserts grains of strychnine into them, and she leaves them lying about in shop doorways and other public places for people to find. After all, who can resist free chocolates? Certainly not me. Then her plot gets more elaborate. She employs a series of boys to go and buy her some chocolates from Maynard's. She puts poison into the chocolates. Then she sends each boy back again to the shop, saying that he bought the wrong type. The shop assistant, unsuspecting, would take back the poisoned chocolates, put them into stock, and sell them to the next customer. One of those customers was the uncle of poor little Sydney Barker. Gwen, let's think a bit more about what might have driven Christiana to undertake her poisoning spree. 20 years before this, she'd been diagnosed with something called hysteria, as had one of her sisters. What did the Victorians think that hysteria was?
The idea of hysteria was very common in Victorian times to explain women's nervous distress, but really it was a catch-all term that was not based on any kind of medical finding. But it was helpful to describe women who suffered from physical aches and pains that had no obvious medical explanation. Hysteria was the kind of term that was used for high-class ladies and ladies who were educated. There's been a lot of interest in how the idea of hysteria might arise from women who are forced into a passive, inactive role, particularly someone like Christiana, who was clearly quite intelligent and someone who did indeed have strong passions.
Gwen, I think that maybe Victorian attitudes towards unmarried women could be relevant here.
I think so too, because she was left alone with her mother in her early 40s. She'd complained of a lot of physical symptoms, which often goes with unresolved distress. And I wonder whether this attachment gave her a focus in her life.
She had fallen into this, to us it looks like a trap, the unmarried daughter who's expected to stay at home and give her life to household duties and being good and quiet and unmarried.
Well, this is been a question for unmarried women for a long time, and particularly in the 19th century, I guess, where there were gender role expectations around women that they would leave home and make a good marriage. And although there are lots of exceptions, there are plenty of women who didn't get married and forged careers, nevertheless, you had to be quite psychologically strong and robust to do that. And it seems to me that Christiana Edmonds was not strong or robust.
I think for Christiana and her mother, though, they must have been concerned that Christiana's father and brother had died in mental asylums. Victorians believed that mental illness was hereditary, didn't they?
The idea that her father and brother had died in these circumstances, I think, might have made her mother very alarmed about her preoccupation with Dr. Beard as it became more and more intense.
I'm feeling sorry for Christiana's mother at this moment.
Yes, me too.
And there are some things about Christiana. There's ingenuity and creativity and cleverness to her, as we will now discover. How did she get hold of the strychnine, for example? The laws concerning the purchase of poisons are pretty tight by the 1870s. So Ross Crone, back in Brighton, was keen to uncover just how Christiana got hold of so much strychnine.
On the 28th of March, 1871, Christiana went to the shop of Isaac Garrett, the chemist on Queen's Road. she said her name was Mrs. Wood, and asked Garrett if she could purchase some strychnine to kill some feral cats. Garrett explained that the law required someone they both knew to witness the sale. They agreed that Christiana would ask Caroline Stone, the milliner at 7 Queen's Road. Now, Christiana did not know Caroline Stone at all, but undeterred, she went to her shop, purchased some items, and managed to sweet-talk Caroline into witnessing the purchase of 10 grains of strychnine. Through April and May, Christiana, still posing as Mrs. Wood, developed a friendship with Garrett to maintain her supply of strychnine and to deflect suspicion. She spoke to him at length about her cat problem, and she even brought him asparagus from her garden. The point here is that Christiana came from and moved within respectable society in Brighton. She had a certain polish. People trusted her, and this made it easier for her to get hold of the poison she needed for her plan.
By the end of May, Christiana had ditched her false name of Mrs. Wood. She moved on to a new fraud of impersonating other chemists in the town. She'd forged notes from them claiming that they needed to borrow some poison from Isaac Garrett because they'd run out. But by this point, Garrett is becoming increasingly suspicious, and he pays a visit to the police. So, Gwen, it's not surprising to me that Christiana has decided to carry out her crimes using poison. It's one of the means that's readily available to her, isn't it, as a middle-class woman?
Well, it always used to be said that poison was a woman's kind of weapon. And this is at least in part because women who were violent, who had kind of dangerous plans for other people, didn't have access to kind of brute force. But I think Christiana's plans are very intriguing because what we see in this woman is a complex, systematized, delusional system in which she really believes that if she can only convince Dr. Beard that she didn't poison his wife, then he will come to her and they'll live happily ever after, which is getting increasingly kind of irrational.
I'm slightly in awe of all of these deceptions that she enters into, like pretending to be a chemist herself and writing to all of these different people in order to get hold of the strychnine. Do you think there's an element of a game here? Can I get away with this? How far can I go?
Well, I wonder whether she really did believe that she was kind of a superior being. And I think it may well have been a kind of entertainment for her. And again, gave her something to do, gave her a kind of focus, gave her a sense of achievement, perhaps, to see something through. But always, I think, with the idea that this will be the thing that will bring Dr. Beard to me.
Well, Christiana is pretty clever, but she's not clever enough. Inspector Gibbs of the Brighton Police has a look at these notes that she'd written to the chemist to get the strychnine, and he takes them to an expert graphologist, the study of handwriting being quite a new profession, and the writing is identified as hers. As the police net closes in upon her, though, Christiana has other unexpected moves to make. She now sends boxes of poisoned cakes and fruits to herself to try to present herself as one of the victims. And she also sends poisoned packages to several respectable Brighton families. One of them is addressed to Emily Beard and contains a note.
I am sending a few homemade cakes for the children. Those wrapped up are flavoured on purpose for yourself to enjoy. You will guess who this is from. I can't mystify you, I fear.
Dr. Beard has had enough. He goes to the police and Christiana is arrested. She's charged with the attempted murder of Emily Beard and later with the murder of Sydney Barker too. She's taken off to Lewes Prison. You won't be surprised to learn that there was huge local interest in the case. Ros Crone went to meet Lynn MacDonald at the East Sussex Record Office to find out how the local paper, the Brighton Gazette, reported Christiana's story.
Here it is, the Brighton Gazette. It's a big broadsheet, and we've got issues that have been bound up together in this lovely volume.
It's a weekly newspaper. It's got this fabulous masthead. It says The Fashionable Chronicle, and it's very much aimed at the middle class of Brighton.
As I understand, the editor, William Curtis, was actually one of the victims of Christiana Edmonds. She sent him some of her poisoned fruit and cake on the 10th and 11th of August.
Yes, she did.
So I imagine he might not be very well disposed towards her. Looking at this edition from the 24th, you can just see how much newsprint, how many columns have been devoted to this story, especially because at the time when Christiana is going through those committal hearings at the magistrate's court.
So, Ross, I said it was a weekly edition, but actually on the 31st of August, this case was so exciting that they were actually publishing it three times a day.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. Look, they even give the times at which the editions are published. They've got one here at 12 p.m, one here at 1:45 p.m, and one here at 4 p.m. It's just like refreshing news on your phone. And I've actually never seen this in 19th century court reporting and newspapers before, so I'm actually rather excited. I wonder if this reporting also gives us a bit more of a sense of local feeling, the kind of perhaps the outrage in the community.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a key article here in the edition from the 30th of November.
This is fascinating, actually, because here we've got kind of widespread denunciation of Christiana by the local press. Also photographs of her on display in public places around the county. And down here in this paragraph, the burning of Christiana's effigy at Guy Fawkes celebrations in Lewes on the 5th of November. Now, bearing in mind, Lewes was then, as now, host to the largest and most rumbustious Guy Fawkes celebrations in England. Yeah, no, that's, you can see how this would really potentially a kind of prejudice the outcome of any kind of trial that was held in the county.
Because of this press frenzy, it's decided to move Christiana's trial to London. In advance of her trial, Christiana is transferred to London's Newgate Prison. There she's visited by the eminent psychiatrist Charles Lockhart Robertson, and he prepares a report for the court on her mental state.
She is one of those persons on the borderland between crime and insanity. Her whole mind is centred on her certain belief that Dr. Beard desired the death of his wife by poison, and that he would marry her. I conclude that she is so devoid of all sense of moral responsibility that she cannot be regarded as conscious of right or wrong, or morally responsible. Her family history of insanity, epilepsy, and idiocy point to the insane temperament, and is consistent with the deduction that the prisoner is morally insane.
But the jury aren't going to buy moral insanity. They decide that she isn't mad, she's bad, and they find her guilty of murder in less than an hour. The judge sentences Christiana to hang. But the Home Secretary is convinced that she's insane, and he rules that she should go to Broadmoor Mental Asylum rather than to the gallows. Ross, how does this go down with the press?
The medical journals at the time that were becoming more prominent, the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and the respectable press from the Brighton Gazette all the way through to the Daily Telegraph, they thought this is a very, very good decision based on very sound evidence. However, if you look at newspapers aimed at a different social class, for example, Reynolds' newspaper, very much the working man's newspaper, quite radical, that newspaper was very, very concerned with this decision. They called it a great miscarriage of justice. They thought it was because Christiana was a respectable woman. And they wrote, she is a genteel murderess and the gallows is not for such as her. So you can see they're basically saying she gets off because she's posh.
Gwen Adsett, you've spent much of your career working with patients at Broadmoor Hospital. What was it like when Christiana was sent there in 1872?
Well, at that time, it was only 9 years old, so it was relatively new and seen, I think, as a very positive development in the care and treatment of those people who were considered to be criminally insane. And some of the first people to be admitted there were, in fact, women.
We've got her medical records from Broadmoor, from the Berkshire Record Office. What stands out for you?
Well, what stands out for me is that the psychiatrists who were looking after her were very unsure as to whether she was insane. If we would look at this one of these early pages, you can see it says, "I fail to satisfy myself that Christiana Edmonds is insane or irresponsible for her actions." And that was after 10 months of being in the hospital. And it's interesting that the psychiatrist says that he doesn't consider her to be a risk to other people, which is interesting considering that she's being convicted of murder and attempted murder. So I think this represents a nice example of how sometimes the insanity laws are a way to deal with people who are dangerous and who need to be removed from society, but for various reasons perhaps can't be held in prison.
Intriguing. What would happen if Christiana Edmonds were alive today and did the things that she did?
I think it's quite possible that she would be found guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility, because it would be argued that at the time of the offences she was suffering from this kind of psychotic delusional attachment, and it was that disturbed mental state that was driving her murderous actions. But I think that fundamentally her behaviour was driven by a state of mind that was disordered, and that she was probably well placed in Broadmoor Hospital.
There's a final irony to Christiana's story. If they hadn't suffered enough at her hands, the people of Brighton had to pay for her detention at Broadmoor. And she was there for 35 years, until she died in 1907 at the ripe old age of 78. We think of stalking as a modern crime and a male crime. Christiana Edmonds, though, shows that that isn't necessarily so. She used her status as a respectable middle-class spinster to get away with her crimes for many months, and she showed no remorse for the dozens of people she poisoned or for the death of poor little Sydney Barker. But she was clearly a woman who thought of herself as the star in her own story. She had considerable intelligence and ingenuity. If she'd lived in different times and hadn't been constrained by Victorian expectations, who knows what she might have achieved? Well, a huge thank you to Gwen Adsedge, Ros Crone and Lynn MacDonald. Next time on Lady Killers, an enslaved woman on the run with her children in 1850s America is forced to decide whether slavery is a fate worse than death. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. Thanks for listening. If you're enjoying Lady Killers, we have a brand new episode every week. But if you can't wait, you'll find the full series available right now on BBC Sounds.
Can you remember the worst day of your life? How would you feel if someone told you that day never happened? That you were being paid to make it up? For people who've lived through terrible disasters, this is a shockingly common experience. I'm Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent. In the BBC Radio 4 podcast, Disaster Trolls, I investigate how people caught up in the Manchester Arena bombing and other UK terror attacks are being targeted with extreme conspiracy theories and abuse. Join me as I uncover evidence of the trolls blighting the lives of people right here in the UK, who now want answers and justice. To hear the podcast now, subscribe to Disaster Trolls on BBC Sounds.